Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. In each legislative session, Wisconsin lawmakers review hundreds of proposals, each of which, if passed, could have significant impact on residents throughout central and northern Wisconsin. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Siewert. The Wisconsin State Legislature runs a robust website, but it can be challenging to sift through all the information that's available online. The focus of the most recent session has ranged from homelessness to suicide prevention and bolstering adoption. Joining us today are two central Wisconsin lawmakers, Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point, who represents the 71st Assembly District. Katrina, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield, representing the 85th Assembly District. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Because this program was recorded earlier, we will not be taking calls during this legislative roundup. 2019 was a pretty tough year in the Wisconsin legislature. 2020 looks difficult as well, but I'd like to start by asking each one of you, what are some areas of bipartisanship that you're seeing? Pat?
You have to start with me.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as I said before, we're kind of trying to learn how to have a divided government where you can compromise and work sometimes not only with our colleagues on the other side of the aisle, but then even our own caucus to make sure that we can get something through to be able to work toward that. I think a lot of the things that were good came actually through the budget, you know, getting, again, another huge amount for education, changing, adding more for the mental health, expanding some of the reimbursement rates for Medicaid and the roads, which we did, you know, put more money into that. And I think situations like that where we worked and the governor made some vetoes, but overall he was okay with the budget as well. That was something that that came through. Some of the other measures, I know that, you know, working with my colleagues, I think we did a lot with my Children and Families Committee when it comes to adoption, when it comes to foster care. Some of the bills are getting through, some are being a little bit delayed or not picked up by the Senate. So those are some of the hurdles you have to work in. So it's not quite as smooth as I'd like it to be, but you know, I look at it as a learning curve, and maybe hopefully we'll take this and in the next session be able to do a little better job.
Katrina, what are your thoughts? Are you seeing some bipartisanship here?
Sure. So I think, first of all, you know, we have shared divided government, and that presents both challenges and I think tremendous opportunities. And how I've tried to approach the session is speaking with as many Democrats and Republicans as I can in both houses. I think one of the challenges that we have is the Assembly might pass a bill unanimously and then it just never gets taken up by the Senate or vice versa. And so it sure seems like with the two houses and then the governor's office, there's many ways that we can work together. And so one example that I have is I have a piece of legislation that I worked with Republicans and Democrats on that passed a committee unanimously and that I'm really hoping comes to the floor this week or, you know, hopefully soon. And what it does is it allows first responders to basically slow down traffic in emergency zones. It adds penalties for those who injure or kill not only a first responder or emergency worker, but any worker on the side of the road, since Wisconsin really has nothing other than a traffic citation for those most extreme situations. And that's a bill that passed unanimously through the Criminal Justice Committee recently, where we had many fire departments from across the state travel down to the Capitol to testify and sharing incredibly powerful and compelling testimony. So I'm really proud of that bill that I'm the lead author of in the Assembly. And I think it says a lot that, you know, to have a Democrat with their name on the bill first in the Assembly be able to get that bill through the committee, that things are changing in the Capitol because it didn't used to be that way. And so I think bipartisanship is alive, but we have to do much more. Another example is this week we'll be taking up all of the Speaker's task force on water quality bills in the State Assembly. And Those bills are a product of about a year of traveling around the state. We traveled 2,500 miles, heard from 70 organizations, hundreds of folks testifying at 14 different public hearings, from Superior to Menominee to Racine to Stevens Point to Madison to La Crosse. And we produced a series of recommendations and 10 bipartisan water bills that tackle water quality from PFAS to nitrate and bacteria. So we can definitely get things done together.
One thing that's really caused a lot of discussion in this area recently, members of Wisconsin's Hmong community speaking out after reports that the Trump administration is seeking the ability to deport Hmong residents to Laos. Katrina, you posted on Facebook this past week that you plan to circulate a letter in the legislature that's related to that effort. What are you hearing from your constituents on this issue?
Yeah, so I did circulate the letter, and it was sent to our entire Wisconsin congressional delegation, and I also sent a letter to Secretary Pompeo. I've heard from constituents and from people across Wisconsin since I posted the letter on Facebook. I think so far 83,000 people have seen it, and that says a lot about, you know, not only has it gone viral, but people are concerned. So since 1998, 192 members of the Hmong and Lao community in the United States have been deported to Laos. And I think what's important about the Laos government, Laotian government, is they have a long and dark history of human rights abuses. And I've heard from people whose last name, they said, you know, if I get sent back, it's possible I could be killed. We hear from people who have said for decades, those who have gone back have disappeared altogether. So what I'm concerned about, this is a moral issue to me. It's a human rights issue. And for the U.S. government to suddenly decide to sign a repatriation agreement with the government of Laos is concerning because of the human rights abuses and because of its track record of persecuting the Hmong people. These are U.S. residents, some of whom do have green cards and others of whom have criminal convictions for which they've already served their time. And that's incredibly important because we've heard from people who might have committed an indiscretion as a young person who first came to this country. I personally heard from someone in Wisconsin who has been here for decades, committed a crime, served his time, has three children in college, is working full time, and his family is deeply concerned about him being sent back. So this is a human rights issue.
Pat, what are you hearing about this? Are you hearing from your constituents as well?
Not at this time.
Okay.
We just had a hearing last week on a bill that would make May 14th, Hmong's Veterans Day. Senator Petrosky and I with that bill, and we had Hmong individuals who were veterans in the war. And after the bill, we had spoke at the assembly, and it's already made through the Senate. I asked the individuals, I said, you know, is there huge concern on this? Are your family members saying something, your grandkids? And it was only four of them, but they said, no, not at this time. We were trying to do research in this. It sounds like it affects, what, 3,500 to 4,500 people?
4,700 people total.
And you know, the thing that I'm, you know, looking at is that we recognize them as refugees for safety. So hopefully these people will be able to have – if they are getting deportation orders, how long ago, to be able to have another hearing, especially what Katrina had said, if they've served time for an indiscretion that they and possibly could face dire consequences going back, that they would have a rehearing on that.
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about child care. Now, Pat, you're the chair of the Committee on Children and Families, and in Marathon County, the number of regulated child care slots is steadily decreasing. We know this. I mean, there are just not enough regulated slots for children younger than six. The average cost of child care for a year is higher than the average cost of public college tuition. What are state lawmakers doing to address this issue, if anything?
Well, I have been working with Secretary Amundson of Department of Children and Families, and she is aware of this situation that we have. We have talked about it. She thinks one of the best ways of taking care of some of the – and I agree with her – of the shortages here, especially in the north, would be to increase the number of licensed in-home child care. Where the highest wait periods are for infants from 0 to 2. And when talking with some of the – and I've had meetings with daycare providers, that, say, some of the regulations and rules are a little tough. You know, like you can only have so many from birth to 2 years old, and they were wondering could it go to birth to 1 year old, because a lot of times when you're one or a little over, you're in sippy cups by then and you can sit and eat, and so it's a different story than being an infant. As far as the cost goes, that is something that we have to see if there's a public-private type partnership that we could work together, because in the same sense, families are paying so much, as you just mentioned, Shireen, with the out-of-pocket payment for this. But in the same sense, the workers aren't getting paid a large amount of money that are there at the child. So somehow we have to make it a little more affordable, but in the same sense, making sure the people that are in charge of, you know, helping our kids develop so they enter the school system all on the same level playing field, that needs to be addressed as well. It's not something that's going to be solved overnight, maybe with one bill. But what I like is that Secretary Amundson recognizes this problem as well, and it's something I'm going to continue to keep working on to help families because they need more opportunities.
All right. Katrina, one thing I wanted to ask you about, and I want to switch gears here a little bit. You were one of several legislators to introduce a proposal to invest $100 million in state broadband expansion and improve mapping accuracy. So why is this such a priority for you, and where does it stand right now?
Sure. So we recently received news that we have $818 million more than originally projected from the Department of Revenue. And so some of my colleagues and I who represent more rural districts decided to introduce a plan to invest $100 million more in state broadband grants. What we've heard from folks is it can take a while to get those grants. And I've had a couple towns in my district who are able to get them, but it might cover a mile or two or three or four. And people are impatient and are like, oh, I just missed the cutoff. And I commend the governor for putting the largest amount of broadband funds in the state budget than ever before. And that's great. It's a good start. It's a few, I think it's almost $40 million he originally put in. But I also think we can do a lot more. And I view rural broadband as similar to rural electrification. If we're not doing it all at once and it's taking, you know, years and years for people to suddenly have access to it, it's not just a cost issue for people. It's also access to education, access to government documents, promoting their business, supporting their business, and doing commerce. And I hear from farmers who are very concerned. So one of the bills I introduced would specifically put farms as a preference access point in these broadband grants, since many of them are getting cut out of the long-term planning. And then the other piece is that mapping project, where we're determining exactly where the hotspots aren't. Like, where is it that people are not connecting to broadband? I personally have constituents who are paying $300 a month using some kind of satellite package to get their internet. And when I've told people about it, they're like, I don't believe you. So I asked them for the bill. I was like, can I have this bill to show people who don't believe me that I have constituents who are paying $300 a month for internet? And I think at the end of the day, you know, internet should be affordable. It isn't just at this point something that's considered a luxury or an extra thing. It is really a utility at this point for people, like electricity and water, because they need it to do their schoolwork, get information from, you know, about elections or about what their government is doing, be able to do their taxes, you name it. It's really important.
You're listening to Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point and Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield, our guests today on Route 51, as we continue our local legislative roundup. I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield and Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point are in the studio today as we discuss recent and upcoming legislation being proposed in Madison. I'd like to talk to each of you again about medical marijuana. Both Michigan and Illinois, of course, they've legalized recreational marijuana. Minnesota and Iowa have legal medical marijuana. What are the costs and or benefits of for Wisconsin for being the only holdout among neighboring states on this issue?
What a great question. I think first and foremost, yeah, we are on an island at this point. And since 2013, since I was first elected, I have always been a co-sponsor and co-author of medical marijuana legalization legislation. I think it's important to recognize that there are so many people who would benefit from the ability to use medical marijuana legally. I've personally met with and heard from terminal cancer patients, people with PTSD, like our veterans, who've told me, listen, I need this, I need to use it, whether it's debilitating nausea, chronic pain. I think it's important to look at and recognize that in states that have legalized medical marijuana, the opioid rate tends to go down. And, you know, correlation is not causation, but I do think that that is an instrumental number that we should be examining. I've personally heard from people who have said, I would love to not be on pain pills. I would love to not utilize opioids as much as I have to as a chronic pain patient, for example. And I think that medical marijuana is a good step forward. I also think the state should look at decriminalization and legalization. And I'm a co-sponsor of both of those bills as well, because I think the time has come to at least have a thoughtful discussion in the legislature. That doesn't mean it has to be exactly what those bills look like. But other states are, if they're decriminalizing, they're expunging. If they're legalizing, they're expunging. And I think there's so many people out there who have small possession records who are being inhibited from, you know, career paths, housing, and other opportunities. And what really concerns me about that is this is something that is prevalent, and you know, people use it prevalently in society. So for us to assign strong penalties for it when we have cancer patients who could use it, I think is wrong. So I'm excited that other states are taking the lead, and I hope that Wisconsin follows suit soon.
Pat, is there a reason that Wisconsin is not going this route? Is there a benefit to Wisconsin by not?
I don't see it. I'm number two on Representative Felskowski's medical marijuana bill, which I think is an outstanding bill because it does mirror what the state of Minnesota does, and it follows through, but we just can't get a hearing. Now, maybe we got to it a little too late. I won't talk about maybe some of the political things that go on with it, but I remember when I was number when I did the Right to Try bill last session, Representative Clayfish introduced the bill back in 2012, and it took until he said, here, you take it. I've tried it. And so it was 2016 session that it got passed. It took that long. It's going to happen. We're just going to have to keep pushing for this to get through. And I don't know why. I think the benefits are there. We had here in Marathon County, 81% in that referendum said, let's legalize medical use of marijuana. So that's why I'm number two in the bill. It's a good bill. Minnesota's done it. They've done it for years. It's worked. Unfortunately, there's just some things that as you learn, as you go along, and Katrina knows real well since she's been in longer, is that sometimes you got to fight through different avenues to get your message through. So we've run into some roadblocks, but as Katrina said, I think it's a good bill and it will happen down the road. As far as recreational side, that might take a little longer down the road. Just I want to see a little bit more effects, especially with kids' brains and things to that nature.
Katrina, you are vice chair of the Speaker's Task Force on Water Quality. What's going on with well compensation?
Sure. So all of the bills will be up on the Assembly floor this week. And I've had this well compensation bill for 3 years now. And what I'm really excited about is we finally have a compromise. Does that mean I'm thrilled with the outcome? Not necessarily, but that's the definition of compromise. I think when everyone's like, hey, this is kind of what I wanted, that probably means it's better than nothing. And so what it does is, and we've talked about this before on this show, that the main focus of the need for well compensation grant reform is people with livestock are the only ones who can access it if they have a nitrate contaminated well. Nitrate is the most common contaminant in the state. We have tens of thousands of people with this problem who can't access the program. So it removes the livestock requirement and it takes away the requirement that your well has to go above 40 milligrams per liter in terms of nitrate contamination to be eligible. So that it moves it down to 10, which is the health standard. So basically, if you find out your well is contaminated and you're unable to drink water from your tap and you are within a certain income limit, and that's where the point of disagreement went. The current income limit hasn't been changed since 1995. It's $65,000 per household, and it isn't tied to the number of kids you have. So you could have four or five kids and have your total household income be $66,000 and not be eligible for the program. I really want us to change that. It's been decades of a wait for people. But I'm hoping we can do that in the budget next session. And in the meantime, let's get a vote on well comp this session. It passed unanimously in the assembly committee, and I'm hoping we'll get a similar vote on the floor. But what's going to happen is immediately, if the governor signs a bill into law, you know, within months, the grant program will be up and people will be flooding the DNR for help with that program. So I think what's going to happen is legislators are going to hear from their constituents about it when the money runs out, because we appropriate $1.2 million total dollars, which is, you know, right now there's about $400,000 in every biennium. So it's a significant bump, but the need is so much greater than what we have appropriated. So my hope is this is a building block. This is a great start, but I'm already looking at next session increasing the amount of funds that we appropriate for the Well Comp grant program and helping people above that household limit. So my original bill was to get that household limit up to $100,000 per year, because I think I meet a lot of folks who do not have $12,000 in their bank account that they can use for a new well. And, you know, I've heard from people who've paid anywhere from $16,000 to $20,000, depending on how deep they have to go. So I think this is an appropriate compromise. I'm certainly willing to take the deal. It took a year to get us there of compromise and negotiation, but I'm also very focused on building from that and getting better results in the future as well.
Pat, you drafted some legislation that aims to make restaurants safer for people with food allergies. Can you talk about that a little bit? What's that all about, and where do those bills stand?
We had a young man, Carter Sign, that Wausau East. He's a junior this year. He came to me when he was a freshman, and he suffers from a peanut allergy. And he had traveled around the United States to different states and noticed that they notify folks more about food allergies and the possibilities of reactions to those differently in other states than here. So we worked on a couple of bills. One bill was that we would have – and we worked with the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, the Tavern League, and the grocers, because you have to get their input and things if we want to make sure to stream through it. So the one bill is a poster – In the kitchen area, it just reminds them about the cross-contamination and make sure they communicate with the server if there are food allergies.
For the chefs.
Because a lot of times what we found is that the server might take it but maybe not flag it or communicate it well with the chef, and then they cross-contaminate and things to that nature, and they don't mean to do it. We found that the education factor, and that would be another reminder if you see it, but if someone brings out a salad that has, let's say, walnuts or some type of nuts on it, oh, I'm allergic to nuts, they take it back. All they do is pick the nuts off and bring back the same salad. Mm-hmm. So these are type of things we worry about. Right now in Canada and in England, there are servers as well as chefs that have been imprisoned for having these things happen, that people have died from anaphylactic. And I don't want that situation to get there. The other bill was in a year's time that the restaurants, when they change their menus, would put on a situation that on their menu saying, if anyone in your party has a food allergy, notify your server immediately. So those are the two bills. But I'm receiving some pushback on that from my own caucus, because a lot of times they think overregulation, so I'm trying to work on that to see if I can at least get one of the two bills in, because I think it's important that the education factor, I guess the menu's one thing, because some folks already do it, have on their menus, but I want the people in the communication between the servers, and they put signs up saying wash your hands when you return from the restroom as a reminder. I think that something like that would be good, and it's not over regulation. So it just – you deal with a lot of personality, Shireen, and it's like walking on eggshells sometimes. And so I was disappointed at first, but I'm going to keep working on it. But those are – I think are good bills. Just – I personally did not realize the number of food allergies that are happening. And a lot of it is they don't know – I mean, both my daughter, who has a 5-month-old – and also my son with a year old, pediatricians are recommending you give peanut butter to these kids early.
Oh, so that they
so they get – yeah, because a lot of times they think in some of the theories I've seen is that we – it's a harmless – but our systems aren't used to it.
Okay.
And so that attacks it as something that's harmful, and that's why we get the reaction. Huh. So they're actually saying, you know, introduce peanuts and things like that to your kids at an early age, right?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit about college debt. Just saw a report that the average graduate in Wisconsin has about $30,000 in college debt. My kids just both graduated. I mean, they've got a ton of college debt. Mm. I know that in January, Governor Evers created a task force on student debt. It is chaired by the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions Secretary. So is there any legislative effort underway to address the student loan burden in our state?
Yes. So I am the author of a couple bills, and I also put out a package called Higher Ed, Lower Debt, which I'm proud is bipartisan and has received a lot of attention from people across different campuses in Wisconsin. We really need to tackle the root of the problem with student loan debt. So we need to be funding need-based financial aid as a state. And I have a bill that would end the wait list for both technical colleges and UW students who already qualify for need-based financial aid, but the state just isn't funding it. So the demand is there. We're not funding it the way that we should be. I also have legislation called Higher Ed, Lower Debt, which allows everyone in Wisconsin to refinance their student loans like they already can with a car or mortgage. Some people might say, oh yeah, you know, I could go to a credit union and do that. That's true if under certain circumstances you meet the parameters. What this would do is create a new state authority like other states like Connecticut have already done, which you refinance your student loans through that state authority and get down to a much lower rate. I think that's really important. I just had office hours and I met with someone who's 72 years old who has $30,000 in student loan debt. This person is still working. And, you know, we went through all of that, and I encourage her to testify at the governor's task force. But this is a reality for many people, and unfortunately, some people think, this just affects young people, but it absolutely affects people whose Social Security wages are being garnished right now because of their student loan debt. And that's something I think everyone needs to realize. If we want to boost our economy, we need to tackle student loan debt at its root. So we do need to be funding financial aid for those who qualify, like the bill that I have. But we also can help people refinance their student loans like you already can with most other kinds of debt. And I think that's a really rational and reasonable response to the problem. The bill would also allow folks to deduct their student loan debt payments, not just their interest rate or interest paid, which we already can on the federal level, when you file your state income tax returns. And I think, again, that modest relief where you have a few hundred dollars more in your pocket or maybe $1,000 more in your pocket means you'll reinvest in the economy and pursue other dreams or goals that you have. So I think these are things that we should be working on together. And I'm hoping we can continue to have this conversation in the legislature.
I'd like to talk about Wisconsin's voting maps. The governor in January created a nonpartisan redistricting commission, and this is in response to this federal court finding that said that Wisconsin's voting maps were drawn in a way that gave a certain electoral advantage. So what's been the reaction to this? Pat, what's the reaction to this redistricting commission?
Well, we still, we hear nonpartisan, and so we'll see who gets on that. But really, it comes down to our Constitution. Right now, the Constitution is the legislature draws up the maps. Now, this group can draw up a map, and we can look at it. But what I think it's going to come down to is the Republicans are going to have a map. The Democrats will come out with their maps. This commission will come out with the maps. And in all likelihood, like in 2001, the courts will decide where what maps there is and choose from them all. So I guess I look at it. I mean, I'm not against this group. And we'll look at the map, see how they compare, you know, and maybe some will overlap. But in the same sense, we got to follow our Constitution, which is the legislature draws the maps.
What's your thought on this?
So I think it's constitutional for it to have the legislature approve maps drawn by someone else. You can just ask Arizona, who's had a nonpartisan redistricting commission, and that was challenged all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and they said it's constitutional because the legislature still approves the maps. I think the goal is, and we have a bill, the Iowa model, it's modeled after, is to have a nonpartisan redistricting commission draw the maps without regard to incumbents, to parties, to ideology, but just basic math. And there have been models out there like Iowa and Arizona that have worked for decades. Iowa specifically has worked for decades, and I think that's something we should follow. What the governor is trying to do with this commission is to show that we can work together on this, and I'm excited that he did the executive order and that he is willing to lead on fair maps. I think it's important to recognize that counties across the state, whether it's Lincoln County or Portage County or folks all over Wisconsin, have already weighed in on fair maps and the need for nonpartisan redistricting. On every single ballot, I think there are over 50 counties who've already passed advisory referenda saying they support fair maps and nonpartisan redistricting. But the issue is, if the people aren't able to get their legislators to pass fair maps through a nonpartisan redistricting bill, then the governor said, you know what, we'll do a nonpartisan redistricting commission anyway. Obviously, it's up to the legislature as to whether or not they accept those maps. That's still our right. But I think it's important as legislators to listen to our constituents and to be representing them. And they are overwhelmingly demanding, pleading, and urging us to work together to pass good maps that doesn't take into account any party. No politician should ever have the ability to draw their maps. And in fact, it should be the voters who get to decide what their politicians not only get what maps they get elected under, but also how they're elected. And I think people have called these maps rigged. I agree with that. I think when, you know, 200,000 voters speak for one party over another and yet want the other party, Republicans, still get more seats in 2012, it's a great example of gerrymandering. And I think we need to do better. And voters have made it very clear to us, regardless of party.
A lot of those seats were uncontested. Democrats ran unopposed. So, of course, you know, that when you put the contested rates together, 58% of the Republicans won when they were contested.
There's one issue I wanted to ask about. One of our listeners got in touch with me and urged me to ask this question. State lawmakers introduced legislation that gives terminally ill patients the option to have doctors help them end their lives. This is the End of Life Options Act. It would allow mentally capable, terminally ill adults with less than 6 months to live the ability to end their life on their own terms. What's your sense of how this is being received?
I don't think I saw the bill being introduced a while back, but no one's generated talk about this, at least in our side of the caucus.
Mm-hmm. I haven't heard from I might have heard from one or two constituents on it, maybe one opposed and one in support, but it hasn't really risen to the top in terms of issues debated. I know in other states that have debated this, I've read articles about members of the disability rights community having concerns about it, and that's something that I would want to look into further and have conversations about, because obviously I would want to make sure that the law was never misused.
Okay. Let's talk chronic wasting disease. The number of deer testing positive for chronic wasting is continuing to rise. There are some people who are frustrated that the state isn't doing more to track and manage it. So what's being proposed currently to address this issue? I know it's really important to hunters in our state.
Yeah. So I have a package called Healthy Herd, Healthy Hunt. And I met with the DNR and the DNR Secretary Preston Cole months ago and introduced it this fall right before hunting season, and I had conversations with members of both parties about it. What the bills do are based on the recommendations of the Natural Resources Board and Conservation Congress. First of all, we need to make sure we're encouraging people to test their carcasses. So funding testing kiosks across the state is really important, and this bill funds more testing kiosks. Second, we need to properly dispose of our deer carcasses. The prions can be transmitted through sediment and air, and it's just a really important thing that we're not contaminating other counties as we're moving our deer carcass, since many people travel to hunt. So there are carcass dumpsters around the state, but they're not nearly as many as there should be. My goal is to get a carcass dumpster in an accessible location in every county in the state, and this bill would do that. And then it would also educate hunters when they're getting their deer license to properly dispose of the carcass. Finally, we need more funding for research and management, looking at what other states are doing. And the DNR has has started that process. This summer, they met with other Midwest states to talk about the literature review of CWD and what every state is doing. But I think we also need to be doing our own research. And so this bill would fund CWD management and research at a level that it used to be at for the DNR, but hasn't been in over a decade. So these three bills are not only recommended by the Conservation Congress, they, you know, had mentioned, I shouldn't say they support the bills. I don't know if they do, but they asked for these three things. But the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, which is a conservation and sporting heritage group, stood with me when I introduced these bills. And I mentioned then, you know, these are the three things that both the Natural Resources Board and Conservation Congress asked for. And it's simple, doesn't cost too much money, but it's a simple thing that we can do to support the $1 billion hunting industry at a time when our CWD rates are increasing. We have a new deer tested positive in Marathon County, and that affects the entire region. That affects baiting and feeding bans. It affects management issues. And I take seriously our long sporting heritage and traditions. I personally hunt, and that's why I introduced these bills. And unfortunately, they haven't gotten a hearing yet. Well, I did talk to the chair of the Sporting Heritage Committee, which I serve on, but I'm hoping we can really put politics aside on this and get something done because our hunters deserve it.
You're listening to Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point, along with Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield. They're in the studio today on Route 51 as we continue our legislative roundup discussing state legislation that impacts residents in our region. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point and Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield are our guests today as we continue our local legislative roundup. I'm Shereen Seward. One of the questions I'd like to ask each of you to answer is this. What is one piece of legislation you're backing right now that you feel really passionate about?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Katrina.
Well, I
know you're both like,
yeah,
oh,
sure.
What is the one thing?
Oh, yeah. So many. Yeah. So I mentioned earlier, but I want to talk about it again because I really need it to get a hearing in the Senate. It hasn't gotten a hearing yet. So I hope those who are listening are interested in calling their senator and asking for a public hearing. Let me tell you a quick story. So two summers ago, there was an incident in Waupaca where someone was a distracted driver. They saw an emergency scene and they were, I believe, on their phone, and they crashed right into a fire truck. And thankfully, no one was hurt, but I cannot imagine not being able to see a fire truck on the road. And it really shook up the first responders who are already putting their lives on the line every single day. And so Brian Swan, who is the assistant fire chief at the Amherst Fire Department, called me in and said, hey, we need to do something. Like, I'm appalled that this continues to happen. This isn't an isolated incident. So I worked with him and Senator Tustin and a few other folks, like Representative Spear, whose committee had just passed through in the assembly, to draft a bill and introduce it to not only recognize that first responders are already putting their lives on the line and we shouldn't be recklessly endangering them more, but that there should be penalties for people who do. Other states have strong penalties for this. And in Wisconsin, I found in some cases, our first responders have been injured, severely injured and out of work for a year or killed. And the person who did it walked away with a traffic citation. If people don't believe me, I'm happy to send them that information, but these are extremely scarring issues for our first responders. And the issue that struck me the most, sitting in the public hearing, I was openly weeping while two different spouses of first responders were crying and testifying in committee about the incidents that they personally had to deal with. They told me, and I've heard this over and over again, they told me that when they get called to a scene on the road, they are more concerned for their loved one's life than when they have to run into a burning building. When you run into a burning building, you're trained in that. You know that you've got the equipment. You have the proper protocols. What you don't have when you're on the side of the road is any kind of protection whatsoever. You are relying on the responsibility and accountability of every other driver in the state. And so what this bill does is it allows our first responders to slow down traffic just like in a work zone. So you could slow down traffic with clearly marked speed limit signs. But it also gives them the opportunity, if someone goes through that emergency zone that's clearly marked, the same penalties apply in a construction zone. So, for example, we can't use our cell phones in a construction zone. Representative Spiros authored that bill a couple years ago. I said, you know, we should do the same for emergency zones where it's very clear that there's an incident, right? What I heard from firefighters is they've personally witnessed people taking photos of them as they're driving. Again, recklessly endangering their own lives. It doesn't make any sense. So I'm really passionate about this bill. It passed unanimously through the Criminal Justice Committee. I really hope we can get it to the floor in the assembly of the session, and I think we might be able to. But what I'm concerned about is, why hasn't it had a Senate hearing yet? And so if people feel the same as me, if you feel strongly about this, please call your state senator and ask them to push for a public hearing so that we can get this bill passed, signed into law. I also want to mention real quick, it does fund education. So the DOT, we all see the clever signs on the side of the road. They would be required to fund significant amounts of education for folks to think more clearly about how they are, their behavior could affect others, especially as it relates to first responders and other folks on the side of the road, whether it's a utility worker, a construction worker, a police officer, or a firefighter. So I'm excited about this bill, and I really want to get it passed.
Pat, what about you? What are you feeling really passionate about right now?
Well, something that happened earlier in the session that got through the assembly without any kind of hiccups, and that is the homelessness bills. And my homelessness bill in particular, which adds $1.2 million a year, a biennium would be 2.4, but it is for the housing, more grants for emergency housing and housing assistance. It's made it through the assembly. You came out of there unanimously, and for the most part, it's had a hearing in the Senate. They just won't bring it up. And so hopefully, in the time, there are going to be two more times. I hope that somehow they can bring it up and push it through. They got one of the bills, Representative Steinicke's bill. But again, I think that sometimes the Senate sees dollar signs and automatically in their mind say no. They've got to look at trying to get individuals a roof over their head and to be able to get that part done. And then they can work on becoming productive again in the society and actually contributing to our state. So they don't – that's one. And then some of my adoption bills also are being held up a little bit in the Senate from having hearings on that. And to try to get kids more permanent and loving environments – at a little bit quicker pace, I think is important. So those are the bills.
What do you think is the biggest stumbling block with the homelessness stuff? Because there was a lot of talk about this and a number of bills that people were pretty excited about, and then and it just kind of stalled. And is it the dollar signs? Is that it?
I have an inkling that it is. There's a few senators from the southeast portion of the state that seem to look at this and have a lot of concern. At least from what my vantage point is, yes, it is the dollar signs. I don't know if Katrina's heard something different, but I just don't know why this is such a universal type situation to help these individuals that are suffering to be able to get that hand up to move forward. I don't realize it.
One of the things I wanted to ask about, Katrina, one of your colleagues in the Democratic Caucus and on the Water Task Force is Representative Stosh Krasinski. He has been accused of verbally sexually harassing a legislative employee. And I know that Democrats have been calling for him to step down. He said he won't. What is the obligation going forward? And do you think that the legislature as a whole has done enough to address sexual harassment?
So I'm going to answer your last question first. I don't think the legislature has done enough to address sexual harassment. I personally looked into, when we first started having this conversation a couple years ago, how other states and human resources departments across the nation manage this issue. And I think we need to have computer software that is very simple to get, where you have the ability to anonymously complain and it just gets logged and that's it. And your personal information is protected until there's another complaint. And then they investigate and there are interviews. And I think they investigate in the first part too, but many people feel very uncomfortable coming forward because they're worried they won't be believed. And I want to say to any survivors out there, I believe you. So I do think we can do more, and there's a lot that we could do to make it much simpler to complain in a way that doesn't jeopardize your profession. I think the problem with politics is people feel very nervous about, and it isn't their fault, but they rightfully feel nervous about coming forward to lodge a complaint because it could ruin their career. And here's what I have an issue with. When you abuse your power as a member of the legislature and a duly elected official against a staff member who does not have that same power, that is wrong. And it's important to recognize he wasn't just accused. there was an investigation and it was verified. So I do believe he should step down. I don't think that it is a right to be in the state legislature. I think it is a privilege and an honor. And if you abuse the power that your constituents gave you, then you absolutely should step down. And I don't think there should be any excuses, rationalizations, or ifs, ands, and buts about it.
Can we talk a little bit, too, about the property tax cut proposal that Republicans are putting together? Can you talk about that a little bit?
About our issue that we had last week, we just announced, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we came back with the access, and it comes down to the folks that everyone that makes under $125,000 will be able to see a income tax reduction. It also takes another level of the personal property tax, like $44 million, and will reduce that, where a lot of the tax revenue savings that we had in the surplus came from corporations and things to that nature. So we wanted to reach out to more of the manufacturing as well with the personal property tax. And then, again, we're also putting more money into the rainy day fund. We're almost up to $1 billion into that. But it comes down to the fact of the matter is that if we have a project, let's say I try to put it in terms like I want to do a project, and can I do this project? How much do you need? I don't know. Why don't you give me $100? I get the project done. It only costs $75, so I return the $25. Don't you think it's a little easier to come back to the person and ask for money again rather than just say, oh, I have the $25. I want to now spend it on this. And so we're coming back to the people, and if it gets vetoed and things like that, we'll just have that much more money to work with in the next budget.
Katrina, what's the reaction been from Democrats on this?
Well, I think the issue is, first of all, the governor had put out his plan and we never really heard a response. But I mean, the governor pointed out that just a year ago, both Republicans and Democrats said they supported getting us to 2/3 funding, which means the state funds 2/3 of our public schools. And they somehow along the way abandoned that commitment to get to 2/3 funding. The governor's plan would get us to 2/3 state funding for our public schools, but it would also include property tax relief by funding equalization aid. So by giving more money to the schools, the idea is that you wouldn't have to raise your property taxes and hopefully your property taxes would go down over time. His proposal would also fund rural schools, the counselors, nurses, and social workers that I mentioned, and make sure that our special education, the special needs reimbursement rate is actually increased to 100% after $33,000 for schools, because that special needs reimbursement rate has been stagnant for a decade. We all know someone with special needs, and they're required by law, by federal law, to get everything that they need from the schools. But when the rates from the state are so low, what happens is that that money gets taken from other places. And my concern is, you know, we've seen a record number of referenda over the years where people are voluntarily voting to increase their own property taxes to keep the lights on. And this is an opportunity to kind of end those referenda. I shouldn't say end forever, but at least put them on pause by funding the state's share to the schools so we don't have to rely on local property tax revenue. And I think that that's something we should all consider, because it isn't just good property tax relief. It's also doing our duty and supporting our school children who deserve the best possible education.
Before we wrap up, I would really like to give each of you an opportunity to discuss some proposed legislation that you think is going to have a really big impact on your constituents, and or even the issues you most frequently hear about from voters. Pat, start with you.
Well, the thing I guess I hear about a lot is in this session has been the child care and the affordability of it and how it is an economic driver, because it used to be in the day a lot of folks would think about taking a job in a community. They would look at the school systems and how good the school systems were. Well, now it's how good is the child care and the availability of child care. And if they like the job, the schools are good, then suddenly, but we don't have availability to quality child care, they might pass up on that. So I think it's an issue where we have to work on the ability to make it affordable, make it quality, and do it in a public-private type partnership where it's not, you know, overburdening the taxpayers, but in the same sense use it as an economic driver to enhance the state and to get folks in. So I hear a lot on that, And I think, too, I serve on the Corrections Committee, and I do think we need reform there, and especially I would like to see things come through where we can provide training and career opportunities for those individuals that have not only been in prison but in county jails, to be able to have something ready when they come out, a career to jump into and possibly not then return down the road, because I think that's so important for something of that nature. So I'm looking for more correctional. I don't want to build more prisons, and so I think we need to work on a proactive way to get these individuals back into society.
Katrina, what about you?
Sure. So we're having a conversation in the legislature right now about two things that I think are completely related. And one is water quality and the other is agriculture and the sustainability of agriculture from a prosperity and resiliency standpoint. And we have bills for both right now, which fund conservation practices for farmers, since in many cases they just simply either haven't started or are interested but aren't sure if it'll be financially viable, if it's related to cover crops, for example. So when we've got grazing specialists, cover crop reimbursements at $5 an acre, and other best practices for farmers, I think that's going to help with water quality. I also think we need a long-term strategy for water quality. So I introduced legislation to create a clean water fund, which is bipartisan and has a lot of support from leaders in key committees like the Joint Finance Committee. And what the bill would do is it would set aside funds in every single budget so we don't have to fight over where the money comes from, so that we can fund these long-term conservation practices and prevention. At the same time in the legislature, we're having the governor called a special session on agriculture. He's interested in rural prosperity. He wants to support our farmers, many of whom are in crisis or struggling to get ahead. And I think at a time when we are having a conversation about agricultural resiliency and water quality, those two things should never be mutually exclusive. And we need to work together to marry the concept of farm resiliency and profitability at the same time as sustainability. And I'm really excited about that. There's a farm in Marathon County that just was awarded the first farm in North America to get Alliance for Water Stewardship certification, which means they're doing everything possible to support water quality. And we're funding audits for future farmers who want to do the same thing. And I think finding those farmers who want to lead on conservation, of which there are many, and supporting them with support from the state, with financial resources from the state, is going to be key. So I'm excited about where the legislature is heading, and I want to continue that conversation.
Thank you both. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests, Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point and Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer, who is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. On March 20th, Route 51 will move to Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network. Next week, join us for a discussion on the history and craft brewing landscape in north central Wisconsin. Until then, we're heading out of town.